We'll call the Senate. Oops.
Just kidding.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order.
Thank you, and I'll call the House Committee on Revenue to order, and we'll proceed with our agenda for the morning. Paul?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First thing I wanted to mention to you is introduce our new intern. Tana is going to be our intern. She's from Willamette University.
Hi, Tana.
And she's going to work with us this semester and help us on some projects we've got going on. So,
welcome.
So we're pleased to have her with us. The first agenda item is on school finance. One of the things that I think we recognized over the years is that as we work through the budget, we tend to get the school budget comes out of Ways and Means very late in the session. We never get a chance to really rendezvous back with the revenue committees on how those dollars that were actually allocated, how they're distributed to the district. So Dave Beck and Michael Elliott are going to go through that with you on how those numbers turned out.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committees. Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office, joined by Michael Elliott, ever excellent Mr. Michael Elliott. So he's here to correct me if I screw up. So the purpose of this presentation is to get to this chart and how we understand. So this is the bill analysis when Ways and Means pass school budget. And usually, as Paul mentioned, that this is done toward the end of the session. So, and at the same time, it is discussed in Ways and Means. So our committees do not have chance to review this bill analysis completely and thoroughly. So it's a good opportunity for us to review how we get to these numbers. Just to get you started, this box lists all the assumptions that's been made. And we have school district names in the first column, and then ADMW extended, formula revenue distributed to school districts, and later to ESDs, and then dollar figure per ADMW, and it's for 2013 and 14, and 14 and 15. So with that, we're going to go through steps to get there. First, some background information. You know, formula revenue is the sum of two big components: one, state school fund, state contribution, and local revenues for school districts and education service districts. So it's important to combine these two resources to look at formula revenue. So after carve-outs from the top, school districts will receive 95.5%, and education service districts receive 4.5%. Within school districts and ESDs, there are statutorily defined grants and distributions. So to understand, again, to understand the chart that you see as bill analysis, we have to understand the formula itself. And usually during the regular session and interim, we bring in Mr. Michael Elliott to give us briefing. So Mr. Michael Elliott will have some say on, with the focus on weights, we'll have some words.
Thank you, Dave. For the record, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Elliott. I'm with the Oregon Department of Education. This is usually about a 20-minute presentation that I'm going to condense into about five. And to do that, what I want to do is we'll just skip through a whole bunch. We'll skip the history, no history lesson, no current revenues, because that was for 11-13. And I really want to focus on the student weights, because that is the formula distribution. So you get your formula dollars, how do we distribute them to the school districts? And that is through what is called ADMW, or Average Daily Membership Weighted. And it's the weights that are supposed to equal each other across the state. So a weight in Multnomah County equals a weight in Malheur County. The four biggest weights that make up the revenue, or the total number of weights, which are estimating at 665,000 for 2013-14, are the first is the average daily membership resident. That is one student attending a school in your district full-time equals one ADMR. Next are special education students. They receive a full second weight up to 11% of a district's ADMR. So if a district has 1,000 ADMR, the first 110 students eligible for special education or on an IEP receive an additional full weight. The legislature recognizes that that may not cover all special education costs, and so for those districts that have high expenses or high severity rates, they get additional weights above 11%, and that's another formula that is run within this formula. The next big weight would be the ESL weight, or English as a Second Language weight. There's no cap to this, and each of those students receives an additional half weight. To give you an idea, each weight for 13-14 is estimated to be worth $6,500. So a half a weight, we're talking about $3,700. So this is a significant amount of money for districts when you give them additional weights to be used towards these services. The next weights, pregnant and parenting is an additional full weight. The very good news is that there aren't that many students in these programs statewide, so it's a small weight in terms of overall impact to the formula. Students in poverty is a quarter weight. That is one of the four big weights, which are ADMR, students in poverty, ESL, and IEP. Students in foster care and the neglected and delinquent programs also receive a quarter weight. Now, those describe the student weights. There are some weights in the formula that cover district characteristics regardless of what student shows up. So, again, the student weights, they follow the student no matter where that student is. The district weights kind of stay with the district. The remote small elementary school correction, based on distance and number of students per grade, that will give them some additional weights, and then also the small high school correction. And then down in Harney County, we have a union high school district. That is a district that has the high school and serves a lot of districts that just have elementary schools. Students attending the high school get an additional 0.2 weights per student, and then students attending the elementary school get an addition or lose 0.1 weight. And then I believe that's it for the weights. So that's really what I wanted you to be aware of when we talk about weights, when we talk about extended ADMW. That's what we're talking about. And one more thing briefly, extended ADMW, you take the ADMW of the previous year, compare it to the ADMW of this year, the current year, and you take the greater of the two. So that's what's driving the distribution of the formula.
Thank you, Michael. The budget environment for 13-15, there are 197 school districts and 19 at ESDs. Over half a million students in K through 12 expect 0.1% annual growth in enrollment and expect 0.4% annual growth in ADMW. And 13-14 ADMW is estimated to be 665,000. So you see school formula revenue history, and from last biennium to this biennium, we have additional $800 million to state school funds. And local revenue, albeit slowly, increases over biennium. State school funds, you see a little volatility. So big picture, 13-15, the state legislature appropriated $6.55 billion. So these red items are so-called carve-outs. So then there's talented and gifted program, speech pathology and virtual school funding. That's $2.1 million combined. Long-term care and Oregon School for the Deaf. Let me emphasize that long-term care carve-out is a projection at this point. It will be adjusted. And small high school grant, we extended the small high school grant for another 2 years, $5 million. And in the past, this local option equalization grant came from general fund. This time it comes out of state school fund. That's $3.5 million. It's different between 13-14 and 14-15. Mr. Brand Reader calculates this grant every year. And there is one new item, you see, Network of Quality Teaching and Learning. A carve-out amount of $5 million. The total funding for this program is $33 million per biennium, and will escalate as state school funds increases. But then the other $28 million comes from equally school districts and ESDs. We'll get to that. So total carve-outs, the amount you see is $36 million. So from 6.55, you subtract $36 million. The state contribution to the formula is about $6.51 billion. Add local resources, local revenues, the combined resources of school districts and ESDs, mostly property taxes and common school fund. There will be some proceeds from state-managed timber sales. So combined local revenues to the formula is about $3.22 billion. So 6.51 plus 3.22 becomes total revenue for formula. That's $9.737 billion. You carry that over on top. From here, school districts get 95.5%. But their grants should be subtracted. High-cost disability, $36 million per biennium. Facility grant, $20 million, is down from 25 in the previous biennium. Now it becomes $20 million. And school districts' contribution to quality teaching and learning network is $14 million. So formula revenue for distribution available to school districts is 9.229 and a little more billion, excuse me. Now, out of total formula revenue, 9.737, ESDs get 4.5% of it, becomes 438 million, and there's a testing purpose spending about $1 million, and ESD's contribution to the network is $14 million. So available formula revenue for ESDs for distribution is $423 million.
Representative
Berger. Dave, my math is correct. The NQTL total is about $33 million,
yes.
$33 million, and that's for the biennium.
For the biennium.
And is that is it a one biennium, or is that going to be an ongoing, and will it stay at that amount?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Representative Berger, yes, it's going to be an ongoing.
And the amount
is prescribed as these numbers, or is it indexed to anything
indexed,
in this state?
Yes, it's going to be indexed, and as fiscal funds escalates, the...
It's indexed to a percentage of the fund?
Yes.
Not an amount?
To the fund.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to get... I just want to understand, because it's a carve-out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Thank you.
So, from here, actually, it's not just half of what's available for school districts and ESDs to be distributed each school year, but the assumptions that we use is this school fund will be split 49-51 between 13 and 14 and 14 and 15. And then the estimated local revenues for 13-14 and 14-15 are different, actually. Property taxes would go up. And with the common school fund performing expectedly better, the local revenues will be different for 13-14 and 14-15. So for 13-14 distribution, I use 49% of state school fund, and I also use estimated 13-14 local revenue. It's about 1.59, close to $1.6 billion. And use half of biennium carve-outs and specified distributions. And use latest school district data and estimates. For example, ADMW, with hard work from the education department, get the number, use that. Teacher experience at this point is still estimate. And eligible transportation cost for 13-14 still an estimate. So all these combined in our model, we get to 13-14 distribution. A little difference between ODE's projected distribution and ours is that we add back high-cost disability grant. And we assume that this high-cost disability grant will be the same as previous year's reimbursed. So between ODE's projected distribution and ours, with some minor assumption differences, the big difference is high-cost disability grants. So we get to this part, school finance distribution, 13-15.
Representative Gelser?
Thank you. When you distribute the high-cost disability grant to districts, how much they get is dependent on the total amount that's requested, correct?
Yes.
What kind of safeguards are there to look at the costs that are submitted? Recently, we had the chance on another project to look at some estimated costs for high-cost students against the actual IEPs. So where it would suggest about $3,800 a year for physical therapy costs, for instance, the student IEPs would call for like 2 hours of physical therapy a year. Is there a way that there's a to connect the actual services delivered with what is billed to the state under that kind of high-cost title?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Representative Berger, I mean, excuse me.
For the compliment.
Yes. our committee actually is blessed with two education chairs. I would defer the question to Mr. Michael Elliott.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, at this point, we don't have the capacity to really do an audit of the costs submitted. I know that there is an independent audit to make sure that for the maintenance of effort, there's some independent auditing going on for that. But in terms of us being able to look at their costs submitted and in a very detailed way and then compare against other costs, that's a little bit beyond our capacity right now.
And that, so. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that might be something to look at. When we went through, we were looking at many, and I think the focus of this grant is it pulls money out of the state school fund, so for that reason you want it to be accurate, but it's also reimbursing for significant costs, and I think we want to make sure that as much of that gets to where it needs to be as possible.
Yeah, I agree, and of course it is oversubscribed, isn't it, every year?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. We pay about 50 cents on the dollar. So every year we have $18 million to distribute, and every year we have about $33 million of costs being, eligible costs being submitted.
Right. So. Yeah. Thank you. Please go ahead.
So finally, we get to this chart, and let me briefly explain what you see on this bill analysis. Actually, this was, we're looking back. So this the combination of Senate Bill 5519, which is the appropriation of state school fund, and then a lot of changes were made in House Bill 2506, including quality teaching school network of quality teaching and learning network spending. On top, we have assumptions. We assume that state school fund is split between 13 and 14, 14 and 15, 49% and 51%. And local revenue for 13, 14 is $1.597 billion. And then there are little more descriptions that I discussed already, and this distribution chart excludes facility grant. And again, assume the same high-cost disability grant as 12-13 reimbursement, and uses 2013 school data and uses 2013 April school data and estimates. By the way, as new information arrives, we make new distribution charts. And also, property tax data come in only annually. So we're handicapped in reestimating local revenues, but we do our best. Every quarter we reevaluate local revenue estimates, but there's a limit because property tax data is not available every time. So let me go to this 13-14.
In fact, we don't know exactly what the amount distributed to each district was until well after the end of the year that you're paying for, do we?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct.
And for some of the reasons are for the reasons you've indicated.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Please go ahead.
And back taxes are collected, delinquent interests are collected much later.
Yeah.
So they are distributed again.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to add on to that real quick, we do a reconciliation once we have that actual data. So we'll know exactly how much each district collected, and then we'll say, okay, how much were you paid versus how much should you have been paid? So there is a reconciliation based off the estimated data.
So back to this chart, 13-14 distribution. The first column, as I mentioned, indicates or lists school districts. And the second column is AD&W extended. Of course, you compare last year and this year's AD&W and use bigger figure, as Michael Elliott explained to you. And the total formula revenue distributed to school districts, and then per dollar figure per AD&W. So for the state, excluding facility grant, including high-cost disability, dollar figure per ADMW is about $6,800. but this figure includes transportation grants and high-cost disability grants. Again, this is a projection. If you go to agency, YSEP and JDEP, Youth Correctional Educational Program and Juvenile Delinquent Development?
Educational Program.
Educational Program, excuse me. You have a dollar per ADNW of about $6,500. And this is about the figure that ODE uses for general purpose grant. This doesn't include transportation grant, does it?
It does.
It does.
It does.
It does. Okay. So this about $6,500 is when we do the quick bill analysis, then this is the figure we use per ADNW.
My mistake. It does not include the transportation grant. So the $6,500 is just general purpose grant divided by the estimated statewide ADMW.
And it, the last page of this school, school district distribution, page 6, we have low ADMW reserve. This is the reserve account, so that, I mean, this is savings, so that we can distribute later. And the very final page shows ESD finance distribution.
Mr. Elliott. You may not be the one to answer this, but I have a good hunch that somebody at ODE is listening. If I wanted to track over the next 2 years exactly where that NQTL money goes, how would I do that?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Berger, you are correct. I'm not the person to answer that question. However, I will take that back to ODE and we will get back to you on that. I do know that the Department of Ed just hired a person, or they're working on hiring a person to manage that program and help set it up. So they will probably be that, whoever fills that position will probably be the person to answer that question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott.
Well, and I would simply note that when Representative Berger is interested in tracking something, usually the rest of the committee is also interested
yes.
in that topic.
Yes, no, we will get that question answered.
Thank you.
We're done.
No questions for this group.
That was a great answer.
And in conclusion, we're done.
I think this is a good overview. Any questions for them? Thank you. I think you've given us documents that we can ponder over many cold winter nights while we try to figure out what's going on in our local school districts and at the state level. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, Chris is next. Okay. And we're going to do the Betsy Renewable Energy Project definition and division from the Department of Energy. Chris, do you want to introduce that for us?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committees. The next topic, as the Chair just mentioned, is discussion of the winding down of the Betsy program. We have the Department of Energy here to talk about some details about how that has been going and to respond to some questions that were presented by the committee. And then after the Department of Energy, the Association of Oregon Counties has a PowerPoint that they wanted to go through to talk on the same topic.
Great. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, members of the committees. I'm Lisa Schwartz. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and with me today to help answer your questions are Anthony Buckley. He's our administrator of our Energy Development Services Division, and Maureen Bach, our Energy Incentives Program Manager. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before your committees to discuss final issuance of tax credit certificates for the North Hurlburt, the South Hurlburt, and Horseshoe Bend wind projects. I know we have limited time, so I'll just cover the key points in the written testimony that we've provided. We've also included several other documents. First, a Department of Justice memo, a timeline of the changes to the Betsy program, a timeline of certifications for the three wind projects, the Betsy rules in effect at the time of preliminary certification, so those are the 2008 rules, because the projects were certified, pre-certified in 2009, and the updated rules that were in effect at the time of final certification. Those are the 2012 rules. And a list of the remaining pre-certified projects. I want to begin by stating that the department's decision to issue the final certificates for the three wind farms conform both to statute and the department's rules. But there are certainly lessons learned that we can apply going forward as the program winds down. The final sunset is this June 30th. And we can use those lessons learned to give the legislature and the public more confidence that tax credits and other incentives can and should be used to build and innovate in the future. This morning I'll give you some background on the three wind projects. I'll explain how the department reviewed them. I'll also explain why the projects pending with active preliminary certifications don't pose a separate and distinct question. Those projects must request final certification be completed by June 30th, which is the last sunset date. Lastly, I'll explain how the safeguards that the legislature put in place in 2011 for the new energy incentive programs use caps and competition both to limit the amount of the incentives and to spread the incentives across a variety of projects throughout the state. First, briefly, just some background on the three projects. Each has the electric capacity of a natural gas-fired power plant. Each represents an investment of about $500 million. And the project spans two counties, Morrow and Gilliam. Second, you've got a timeline that covers the tax credit certification for these projects. The initial step was back in July 2008 when North Hurlburt Wind LLC submitted an application to the department for preliminary certification. And included was a letter to then-director Mike Graney explaining that while Caithness Shepherd's Flat was the entity that applied to the Energy Facility Siting Council for a site certificate, the certificate holder would, in fact, be North Hurlburt Wind LLC. The letter also stated that there would be, quote, at least four discrete renewable energy resource facilities, each with separate owners, separate financing plans and arrangements, separate structures and equipment, and separate power sales agreements. The application described these arrangements. Later that month, the department received applications for South Hurlburt Wind LLC project and another owned by Willow Creek, which was later renamed Horseshoe Bend. Several employee departments worked together throughout 2008 and the first part of 2009. And in May 2009, the director issued a preliminary tax credit certificate for each project. Then in September of that same year, 2009, the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council amended its original order, recognizing the three wind farms as three separate energy facilities and issuing three site certificates. The final council order stated that the three wholly owned single-purpose subsidiaries will, quote, possess and control separate power purchase agreements, interconnection agreements, land lease agreements, and other facility assets. In 2010, with three site certificates in hand and three preliminary tax credit certificates, the projects began to be built. Skipping ahead to 2012, a tax credit program analyst in the department reviewed the project files against updated rules on separate and distinct facilities. the same rules that are in effect today. His June 1st, 2012 memo reaffirmed that the three projects should continue to be considered separate and distinct. Also in 2012, the department signed three amended tax credit certificates, preliminary certificates that were amended to approve the actual turbines used and an updated energy production estimate based on those turbines. Following construction, department staff made two unrelated on-site inspections. The first, on September 5th, 2012, was a tax credit compliance officer who inspected each of the projects for compliance with the preliminary tax credit certificates. And then on February 28th, 2013, a siting compliance officer inspected the projects for compliance with the site certificates. Throughout, staff continued to conclude that the projects were separate and distinct. So next, I'd like to walk through the department's rule for the separate and distinct facility designation and how staff determined that each of the projects is eligible for tax credit. Statute requires that the department adopt a rule establishing criteria consistent with the definitions in statute relating to what constitutes a single facility. The department's rule requires a finding that facilities are not separate and distinct only if they meet three or more of the criteria in the rule. The department concluded that the three projects are separate and distinct because they meet only one of the criteria in the rule. I'll summarize the department's analysis for each one of the criteria next. First is whether the facility is located on one or more adjacent parcels of land, and the department determined that the projects did meet this criteria because they are located on adjacent parcels of land. Second is whether the facility has been recognized as a license in a license or a permit as a single facility. The Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council recognized and permitted the three wind farms as three separate facilities. The council consists of seven members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and these council members have powers completely distinct from the departments and the directors. They've got rulemaking and decision-making authority that's wholly separate. The council alone, not the department, not the director, issues site certificates. The council's decision is binding on all state and local governments whose permits are addressed in the council's review. And beyond siting-related permits, for example, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issued three separate exemptions stating that each of the three facilities is an exempt wholesale generator, which means that they're involved exclusively in the business of selling electricity at wholesale. Our third criteria in the rule is whether the facilities are constructed under the same contract with a single contractor or multiple contracts entered into within 1 year. And if the facilities are completed in phases, each must independently qualify as a separate facility, and they must not be interdependent in terms of their operation or maintenance. Department confirmed that each facility owner would separately execute equipment and construction contracts with vendors after a competitive bid process, and that the contracts would relate only to each individual facility. Further, each facility is owned by a separate entity. The financing was separately obtained for each facility, and each facility was built to stand alone and not operate dependent on one another, nor is maintenance dependent on one or the other facilities. The department also confirmed through on-site inspections that each project has separate operation and maintenance facilities. The fourth criteria is whether the facility owners have entered into agreements to share personnel, project expenses, or capital investments. Each of the three wind farms has a separate on-site manager, and as far as the department is aware, all of the other employees also are separate and distinct. The application stated that each facility would be separately financed and securitized. And consistent with past practice, the department relied on these representations in concluding that the facilities did not have agreements to share project expenses or capital investments. And further, each facility owner separately executed equipment and construction contracts with vendors after competitive bid process with each facility. In addition, the three substations, the transmission lines leading up to them, and the lines between the three substations and the Bonneville grid are all separately owned and maintained by Caithness Shepherd's Flat LLC, and that equipment does not belong to any of the three wind farms. Finally, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission determined that their transmission facilities are, quote, limited and discreet. The fifth part of our rule is whether the generating equipment for the facility and any related facility was purchased by the same persons who own or operate the facility. In the applications for preliminary certification, the owners represented that each individual facility would procure and finance equipment separate in part from the other facilities. As a standard practice, the department has largely relied on representations of facility owners that equipment purchases were separately undertaken. But at the time of final certification, for projects that cost more than $50,000, statute requires that the project owner hire an independent certified public accountant. The CPA reviews the contracts, the payments, and other documentation and provides a letter to the department attesting to costs specific for each project. The CPA letters the department received confirm the payment dates and the amounts, and these were different, the payment amounts and dates. Moving on to the sixth part of our rule, that can be met either by connecting to the grid through a single connection or connecting through multiple connections but sharing a net metering, power purchase, or other transmission agreement. While the department found that power was aggregated at a so-called ring bus, which is a type of switching configuration inside a substation, at Bonneville's Slat substation, each of the wind facilities uses a separate substation located on its site through which it transmits power to that Bonneville facility. The department's determination about connection to the grid relies on that first point of interconnection. In other words, the separate substation at each facility, at each project site. Therefore, each wind project separately connects through these individual substations to transmission lines owned by Caithness Shepherd's Flat, LLC, which in turn transmits the power to the Bonneville grid. Further, Bonneville Power Administration entered into three separate interconnection agreements with each of the facilities. Those govern the interconnection of each facility to the grid. Therefore, the department determined that there are multiple connections to the grid. So that's the first part of the rule. Regarding the second part, each wind farm entered into a separate power purchase agreement with Southern California Edison, and the California Public Utilities Commission approved each individual power purchase agreement to go into rates. And finally, the seventh part of the rule is other factors or considerations which demonstrate that the facility is not separate and distinct in its construction, operation, maintenance, or output. The department did not find any such other factors or considerations. To the contrary, a number of entities reinforced the department's determination that the three wind farms are separate and distinct. The Energy Facilities Siting Council issued three separate site certificates. Southern California Edison signed three separate power purchase agreements. The California Public Utilities Commission approved each of these agreements. The Federal Energy Information Administration assigned three separate generator numbers. They're used to track the metered output of the facility. The Environmental Protection Agency issued three separate registry numbers for environmental regulation. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approved three separate exempt wholesale generators. Bonneville Power Administration signed three separate interconnection agreements. And in 2010, the U.S. Department of Energy revised its loan guarantee in part to reflect that, quote, the wind project is now divided into three separate wind facilities and owned by three separate entities. The IRS issued three separate employer ID numbers, and the Secretary of State in Oregon registered the wind farms as three separate entities. So to summarize, the department concluded that the three projects meet only one of the seven criteria in the rule. And again, unless a group of projects meets at least three of the criteria, the facilities are considered separate and distinct, and each one is eligible for a tax credit. While the 2011 legislature ended the BETC program, there are 135 active preliminary certifications in 23 Oregon counties. These projects have just until June 30th to complete construction and submit applications for final approval. And we provided a spreadsheet that shows each of those 135 projects. Two-thirds of them are conservation projects, so these are things like lighting and heating upgrades. The department reviewed the remaining 47 renewable energy projects and determined that none of them raises a separate and distinct issue. Some of the projects share the same owners, for example, the Oregon University System, but these projects are spread throughout the state and are distinct projects, and there are no wind projects on the list remaining. House Bill 3672 in 2011 replaced the Betsy program with a far more limited energy incentive program for businesses. First and foremost, all of these incentives have overarching caps. So, for example, for renewable energy projects, they're limited to tax credits of only $3 million each biennium. That's spread across all projects. Conservation and transportation tax credits also are capped. So the caps are the first piece. Second, renewable energy projects are no longer directly eligible for tax credits. Instead, the Department of Revenue auctions periodically tax credits to raise grant funds, and no more than $1.5 million per year in tax credits auctioned per fiscal year. Third, renewable energy projects have to compete against each other for that limited pot of funds. And no project can be bigger than 35 megawatts. Conservation tax credits also are competitively awarded. So these are periodic solicitations by sector. So they're competing against one another. Finally, there are limits strictly on renewable energy projects. Each project can receive no more than $250,000 up to a maximum of 35% eligible project costs. Thank you for the opportunity to walk through our process for determining that the North Hurlburt, the South Hurlburt, and Horseshoe Bend wind projects are separate and distinct under the department's legacy Betsy program. We're confident in our decision. These projects involve highly complex technical, financial, and implementation issues. And in the same way, determination of tax credit eligibility is not a matter of simple judgment. The department extended its review process for these projects to determine that they're separate and distinct according to our rule and statute. Our review process included a reexamination of all of the materials provided by the applicants throughout the entire process, attestations by independent certified public accountants, supplemental documentation, and on-site inspections by two programs, both in our tax credit program and our energy facility siting program. And the department was not alone in its determination. Other state and federal agencies, along with the purchaser of power from each of the facilities, also treated the projects as separate and distinct. But going forward, the department will apply lessons learned from this process. We're going to review our program rules so that they provide as clear guidance as possible for issuing incentives to the letter of the law. At the same time, rules must strike a balance between achieving the energy savings and other investments intended and giving the legislature and the public confidence that the department's review is proper and thorough. We'll continue our statewide outreach to businesses and other stakeholders to make sure the rules are workable for businesses and other participants, and at the same time, rigorous enough to protect the public interest. With new leadership, the department will continue to improve on the safeguards the legislature already has put in place for energy incentives going forward, while ensuring that the programs meet statutory goals. Please feel free to contact me at any time if you'd like more information about these three projects or our new tax credit programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I think we'll start that contact immediately with questions. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Schwartz, I think it's important perhaps to seize upon a final point that you made, that these are not subjective criteria that the department uses in order to determine separate and distinct, but there are, in fact, rigorous processes and standards that are shaped by both statute and rule in making that determination. I would imagine, then, that given that there were projects that were rejected that came in as separate applications but were in fact determined to be a single project. Is that the case? And If so, I would imagine that those projects are those developers are probably interested in challenging the department on its ruling and looking to get additional credits. How do you defend against that, and what's the difference between this project and those projects?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Bailey, thank you for your question. In fact, yes, the department has combined projects that were applied for as separate and distinct. We have been engaged in a number of matters of litigation. We still have a pending matter of litigation. Altogether, between denying multiple tax credit certificates for many projects and making sure that projects met the statutory requirements for completion of construction within a period of time, the department has protected against about $149 million that could have gone against the general fund. This is also a reason why when we had a request from the media to provide our confidential guidance from the Department of Justice, we were concerned about providing that because we don't want to risk any of these. It had nothing to do with these three projects. In fact, it had to do with everything with other projects where we've denied multiple tax credits as well as pending litigation. So anytime you get into that, you do open yourself up to a bit of risk. In this case, because of the size of these projects, because of the amount of money that was at stake, we did quite an extensive review, far more than than we would do in cases where we're talking about much smaller amounts of money. I took quite a bit of time. If you look at the timeline, I took quite a bit of time coming in as new director in December. This was new to me, so I took quite a bit of time in working with staff and going through how they did their analysis, working with Department of Justice on this, only issuing the final certificates in June for the last of the three projects.
Please. Well, Mr. Chair, yeah. Thank you. Given that you face a threat or a cloud of litigation over any of these decisions that you make, I would imagine then that you have to be very careful about crossing your T's and dotting your I's, especially on a project of this magnitude, and that after that, examination of how these projects conform to your rules and to the existing rules, because they had separate buildings, separate crews, separate contracts, separate power contracts, all the things that you mentioned, which, as an aside, makes sense. I'm sitting next to Senator Rosenbaum, and we're of the same party, but we're definitely separate and distinct. should be so lucky to have her intellect. I would... while that determination was made at the time, what I hear you saying is now, going forward, we've changed the rules under 3672, and that this is really an issue that's looking backwards, not an issue that's looking forwards. Is that correct?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Bailey, we actually reviewed these projects against our today's current rules, 2012 rules, so this was really rigorously reviewed. So the in 2008, when we received the preliminary applications for preliminary certification, we reviewed the projects against the then 2008 rule. So you have that rule in front of you, so you can see how the rules were updated over time and made more rigorous. In 2012, we updated the rules, and we subjected this final review for the final certifications against today's current rules. So they have been made more rigorous as a result of legislation and higher scrutiny by the legislature.
Final follow-up?
Please, yeah.
Thank you. And in addition to the more rigorous rules and the additional scrutiny, it is the case, correct, that the program is ending and that we have an entirely new program that's beginning going forward. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bailey, that's correct. House Bill 3672 finally ended and completely ended the program. And so the very last sunset date is this June 30th, 2014. And so we, under this program, only have that remaining tail of the 135 projects you have in the spreadsheet that you have. And there are no wind projects on the list whatsoever. About two-thirds are conservation and just a remaining 47. So this is the very end of the tail. The new program is really different We're talking about much lower amounts of incentives. The programs before didn't have overarching caps under Betsy. Now we've got very strict caps for conservation, separate from the caps for transportation, separate from the really small caps for renewable energy projects. And then we require competition for the renewable and conservation projects, where we compare projects across. And there are new rules also for those programs. They're really very rigorous rules that we go through for projects that actually get through and rise to the top when we issue the competitive solicitations for them.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You alluded to this, that you basically complied with the statutory directive that, and this is from the 2010 legislation, that the director shall subject facilities with higher projected costs to closer scrutiny, shall compare projects of similar costs against each other, may certify less than the total cost of any facility based on this evaluation. Now, can you go into more detail about what was the nature of your extra scrutiny before you issued the final certification?
Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, we did subject these projects to quite a bit of additional scrutiny. You have before you a memo from the Department of Justice that we're releasing to give you a flavor for the determinations that the department made in each case and the way that Department of Justice views our authorizations to interpret both statute and our rule in that way. And as I mentioned, I took quite an extended time period, I think, beyond what was actually allowed under statute and rule to review these projects. It was quite an extended review timeline. So we as a team at the department went through every bit of information that we received on these projects. Again, looked very very tough at the CPA attestations that were provided, including the bills showing the different, you know, the payments were made, the different dates, the different bank accounts. We went again through not just our own determination, but making sure we were benchmarking against other state agencies and federal agencies that had to provide the permits and the licenses, the other regulations that also applied to the projects, and made sure that there was nothing really that we were missing that we hadn't reviewed, that another body may have reviewed, even if it was out of our state, even if it was at the federal level. I don't know if I've got Anthony Buckley here, if you want to provide any elaboration, or Maureen Bach.
No, the only elaboration I could possibly provide, Chair Burdick.
Could you identify yourself for the record,
please? I apologize. Anthony Buckley, I'm the administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy's Energy Development Services Program. Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, the only thing I would add, members of the committee, my apologies. We challenged ourselves on everything we knew in issuing the original pre-certs and in issuing the final pre-certs. The further scrutiny was in everything that the director has mentioned, and us challenging as a department all of the information we had, and I'd leave it at that.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. One of the developments that happened between pre-certification and certification of this project, and this is a related but separate issue from the three. From the separate and distinct issue. But during that time between the pre-certification and the final certification, there were a whole slew of federal incentives and even some more additional state incentives that were available for these facilities. And one of the things that struck me when I first got into this issue is the Betsy program just operated as almost a silo without recognizing these other incredible incentives that came into some of these projects. In the 2010 legislation, we gave you authority to look at the rate of return and to look at the whether the incentive was actually needed to have economic viability. What analysis did you do to make that determination? How did you go about determining whether $30 million of incentives, which is comparable to 333 school teachers that the taxpayers are paying for. How did you determine whether all of that money was necessary given all the other incentives and given the private investment and the basically the structure of the energy, industry, which was very close to being completely economically viable on its own?
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, I'm going to ask Anthony Buckley or Maureen Bock to respond more specifically to your question.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, excellent question. With respect to the action taken by the legislature in 2010, House Bill 3680, that action was visited on pre-certs going out, or new pre-certs. Existing pre-certs, we didn't have that authorization to take action on. With the new pre-certs under the caps that were imposed with that legislative bill, they were, the renewable projects went through a much more rigorous process with regard to economic impacts, rate of returns. There was no directive on existing pre-certs to review them again. Maureen, do you want to add anything?
I believe that's not the case. I'm trying to look here in the actual statute, but it does. I know the intent of the statute was to make sure that when you're actually awarding the tax credits,
final cert,
through the final certification, that there had been cases even earlier where they found out that by awarding a tax credit, they would be actually exceeding the cost of the project, and they were able to reduce it then. So in this case, the intent was to pick these up before final certification. And are you saying that you interpreted it differently and felt that you had to give all $30 million and could not take into account any of the other incentives that were available?
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, at the time of final certification, we do ask for
disclosure. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Oh,
please?
I'm sorry.
I appreciate
this
that.
Is Maureen Bock. I'm the Energy Incentive Program Manager for the Department of Energy. And at the time of final certification, the application does request information about other incentives received. So the federal production tax credit and investment tax credit and those things are disclosed by the project owner. And those are attested to by the CPA, and so those are revealed to us. These projects each were a half a billion dollars roughly in project cost. They have certified project cost only of $20 million, which is why they were eligible for the 50% energy tax credit here in this state, which did not come close to even meeting what they were spent in the state in building these projects.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up.
Please, yes.
The statute also gave you the authority to bring in outside consultants to help you determine the economic viability and the basic compliance with the program requirements. Did you ever take advantage of that and bring in an independent analyst to look at this project, which is, I believe, the biggest project you've had?
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, not to my knowledge did we bring in an outside consultant to review, and I'm looking at my staff here and I'm getting confirmation of that answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President. That's all for now.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I first make sure that staff relayed my, I think I wrote out 10 questions for the Department of Energy. Was that passed on?
You know, Chris? Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Thank you. So, on the record, can you respond to those questions, not now, but perhaps in writing, and then we can put them in the record?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger, we'd be happy to do so.
Thank you. So, your testimony, Ms. Schwartz, raised a number of questions for me. I was going to rely on those 10 questions, but...
Just to be clear, excuse me just a moment. The what you're referring to is your email of September 14th?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. And you've received that? Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about following the statute and rules and rigorous review and some other things. And so I was looking back at notes that were taken at an inspection by the Department of Energy, and this occurred on June 1st, 2012. And the inspector notes that one of the factors you mentioned, there's three adjacent parcels, so you had already talked about that, acknowledged it. He goes on to note that there's one general manager and one main point of contact on all three applications, and that individual, your inspector notes, therefore that generating equipment for the facility and the related facility was purchased under the authority of the same person. The inspector then goes on, and I think that is one of the factors that you had mentioned about separate purchasing of equipment, et cetera, et cetera. So this is contradicted in the report of the Department of Energy's inspector. The inspector then goes on to say three separate site certificates from the Siting Council, which you noted in your testimony. The three projects will be built under general contractors selected through a bidding process. You noted that as well. And each qualifying can operate independently. He then concludes the agreements are written to exclude shared resources, and there are three separate power purchase agreements. So your inspector notes two factors out of the seven that presumably would not be met, or would be met, I'm not sure which, would be met to disqualify, I don't want to use a double negative and make this confusing, but would be met to disqualify the project. And then in a prior inspection, and this one's dated, I'm sorry, a later inspection, this one's dated in September, an unnamed inspector notes the project share a common ring bus located at the substation for one of the projects and the same interconnection. The notes conclude, beyond those two shared items, Mr. Talovich, who was on site apparently, assures that the projects are autonomous. So I think the first question I have is, given that there are three factors mentioned in the inspections, these two inspections about 3 months apart in 2012, and if those criteria are met, the separate and distinct standard under the Department of Energy's rules wouldn't be met, so it would be deemed one project. That seems contrary to your testimony, and I'm just curious what happened that would change from that date to now and what was noted in those inspections.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger, the department found that only one of the criteria met, the adjacent parcels, so that's criteria one. In regard to the ring bus, which we talked about, that's a type of switching configuration inside a substation, that ring bus is inside the Bonneville facility at the SLAT substation. As I mentioned in my testimony, as Department of Justice memo also discusses, the department goes to the first point of interconnection, which is a separate substation at each site. So we found as a department that it did not meet the criteria. That ring bus didn't raise. We completely vetted that issue over a period of time and concluded that because of these separate and distinct substations at each individual project site, being the first point of interconnection, that's not a concern, did not meet the criteria. In terms of the general manager, that's disclosed both in my written testimony and in Department of Justice memo, that while there was a general manager that was on the paperwork back in 2008 before the project was constructed, when they were still putting together financing, still awaiting their site certificates, that was an initial determination we made that that criteria might have been met, but as the project evolved, became three separate projects. There are three on-site managers, separate for each project, and as far as we're aware, all other personnel are separate and distinct. So we found that criteria was not met.
May I follow up, Mr.
Please,
Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Schwartz, the inspection stated June 1st, 2012, where the inspector says there's one general manager, not 2008. So I'm not sure where the disconnect is there on the 4 years that we lost. But this is, I'm just reading from DOE's inspection. Also, on the September inspection notes, it says the ring bus is located at the substation for North Hurlburt. And then it says, and they share an interconnection between the three phases of one project. It doesn't say that. That was commentary. So that's inconsistent with your testimony. I don't know which one is true, the inspections, or what you said in your testimony. But by implication, that doesn't suggest that there was very rigorous review or extensive scrutiny, I'm quoting, of these projects. I'd like to move on from that because I don't expect you to answer differently from your testimony, but I think you should look back at these reports from Department of Energy's own inspectors and find out what people saw when they were on the ground at these projects. And again, these are from 2012. May I have another question?
Please, yes.
Thank you. So you talked about, again, the criteria and the administrative rules that you're following when you're making a determination as to whether or not this is one project or three. And one of the criteria includes whether or not the project has been licensed or permitted by any, as one project, as by any level of government. And I noticed you relied a lot on the siting council's determination that there were three separate siting certificates, which was a change, as you acknowledged, from the beginning. But in the beginning, the Facility Siting Council, which is, I don't think, is making determinations about whether it's separate projects. It's just issuing siting certificates. But in the beginning, the application was for one project, and there was one certificate issued. Can you address whether or not that should have come up in your determination about the criteria of licensing or permitting as one project?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger, in my written testimony, we do discuss the Energy Facility Siting Council originally permitting one project, and as that project evolved, it recognized and, in fact, did make a determination and did have to recognize that there were three separate projects in order to be able to issue three separate site certificates.
Does the Siting Council apply the same criteria that the Department of Energy does in making that determination? I'm asking. I don't know. I'm just asking.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger, the Energy Facility Siting Council is described as quite separate from the department. Although the department staffs the Energy Facility Siting Council, each council member and the council as a whole is vested with wholly separate powers and authorities regarding the rulemaking and the decisions that they arrive at, including issuing the site certificates. So their criteria for separate and distinct, in using the same terminology, it's different, but it's similar. For example, in my testimony, I talk about the separate land lease arrangements. I don't think we don't explicitly have in the Department of Energy rules on separate and distinct facilities talking about land lease arrangements, but they do at the Energy Facility Siting Council. So that's an area where, in fact, they have, you know, additional detail that's not present in our rule. They do talk about separate power purchase agreements. They do talk about separate equipment like towers, the transformers being separate. They do cite all of the, many of the same criteria. They also have additional criteria, and they have different criteria. But they do have to make a determination on separate and distinct. And yes, it's correct that the department relies quite a bit on the Energy Facility Siting Council's determination in that regard as well.
Okay, Paula?
Please, yes.
Just quickly, I'll point out that if you were thinking about from the perspective of a developer, and I'm not talking about someone who is
committing fraud or anything. I'm just saying someone who's looking at the rules. Do you think it would be fairly easy to take one land lease and one power purchase agreement and split it into three parts? And do you think that that would be something that, if that happened, maybe the department would look at that and think, this might be at least violating the spirit of our rules?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger, the department did look at all aspects of the project, including the separate power purchase agreements, the separate LLCs, and so forth, and made a determination that the projects conform to the statute and our rules, and that's really the basis that we have to use to make the determination.
We're running out of short on time, and I'd like to just read to you from another permit. This is related to the same question. This is the Bonneville Power Administration's record of decision. It's recognizing one interconnection, and this is in 2008, so it may have been amended or changed, like everything else. It's recognizing in this record of decision, which is July 2008, it's recognizing one interconnection for one project at Shepherd's Flat. It notes the site certificate from the Energy Facility Siting Council and approves one interconnection for the project. Again, this was permitted as one project at some point. The question is, in the application of the rules, I didn't see anywhere in the rules where it said that it is currently permitted as more than one project. I saw if it has been permitted or given a certificate or some kind of approval from any level of government, that was one of the factors in determining whether it was separate and distinct. So that was two. I'll let you answer. I'm sorry.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger. That's a good question, and I think we've been very consistent. We applied our updated new rules to this project, even though it was it applied to the department in 2008. It received preliminary certification under our 2008 rules. We approved amended certificates in 2011. And so we applied all of the current information that we had, because I would expect certainly that this body would want us to do that, to ensure that we included all of the information that we're currently aware of. And for example, in a revised record of decision in 2010 by Bonneville Power Administration and the U.S. Department of Energy, they squarely recognized the projects as three separate projects. And as included in my testimony, we looked at this because this was the current information and the current determinations by other bodies and not just our own.
I think you answered my question, and without trying to put words in your mouth, I think what you said is, no, you don't look back at how it was originally permitted. You only look at the current permits. Was that an accurate restatement?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger, I think it would be more accurate to say we looked at all of the body of evidence from the beginning of the projects to the end, but we need to pay attention to what's currently in place, because that's actually how the projects stood at the time when they came in for final certification. Time marched on. The project at that point had been securitized, had been financed, had been constructed, had received all its permits, its site certificates, the interconnection agreements, the power purchase agreements, and so forth. So we have to take into account the final state at the point where the project comes in requesting a final certification of tax credits, each one.
Yeah. Ms. Schwartz, that was more or less a yes or no question. And I know I'm running out of time, and I hope I can ask a couple more questions.
Yeah, please, if you can do it briefly.
I will.
I'll a couple, and I suspect other people do as well.
Okay. Well, I can wait if someone else has questions.
Are there other questions? We discussed this issue on the phone a few days ago, and I appreciate very much the conversation that we had at that point. As I'm listening to you talk today, I think I'm sort of building on the questions Representative Conger has asked already and that Senator Burdick asked. It appears to me as though the rules that we've had in return for a $20 million payout, the difference between one project and three, would be a substantial incentive to get the paperwork right, to make changes in the way the project is set up in order to encourage the department to find exactly the way it did. And so the questions I have really sort of go from that. Do you know, for example, who the owners of the three LLCs are and to what extent those owners are related to each other? I'm asking, really, did you pierce the veil and go backwards a bit to figure out who the what the motivating force behind these three entities is?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, first I wanted to state that the statute does not require separate ownership. In fact, I think as Representative Bailey, mentioned earlier, you could be separate and distinct in a variety of ways. You know, you might be, say, a wind developer and develop projects in various places in the Columbia Gorge, in various parts of the state. So the statute does not require separate ownership. The statute requires that we look at the projects and the facilities being separate and distinct.
Look, the reason I'm asking this question is that I'm trying to understand the extent to which it's possible for a developer to take a project contiguous in space, working on the same kind of project, working with things that are closely related in time, that's going to connect to the same power distribution system, that's going to sell to the same purchaser in California, that's going to do a whole lot of other things that are very closely related. I'm not talking about the State Board of Higher Education building a conservation project at Eastern and a solar project at the University of Oregon. Those are obviously separate and distinct. I'm talking about the things where so much of this looks like we're talking about one project. And then Representative Conger raises the question of, or the issue, that the original applications were for one project. It was only later that these things got divided out and broken up. And I'm wondering to the extent to which this was done purely for the object, for the purpose of getting the state of Oregon to part with an additional $20 million. And I don't know whether you can answer that question or not, but if that was done, and if, in fact, you followed absolutely all the rules, then I think what it does is it raises a question about the nature of the rules themselves and whether we needed to do something different in order to prevent what certainly appears to have happened.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, we created those separate and distinct rules specifically for renewable energy facilities because, in fact, you're absolutely correct. Those are the types of projects that you would tend to find would raise the separate and distinct issue. You know, conservation projects really are done on individual systems, typically on existing facilities, so they really don't raise that same issue. So it really is an issue that's about renewable energy facilities. So to clarify first, though, I want to say that the applications to the department for tax credits came in separately. Each project came in separately. So the North Hurlburt facility came in first. Later that month, we received the applications, the separate tax credit applications. It's I think we were talking about the Energy Facility Siting Council initially, which is a separate process entirely, separate body entirely, receiving a single application at first. Early on in the process, because it takes a long time to raise $500 million for each project, I would imagine. But getting to your specific question about developers being able to be, having an incentive of, in this case, $20 million to present and develop the projects, in fact, separately and distinct. I would say that they actually develop the projects separately and distinct. I don't think the only reason is for this tax credit, but it certainly provides an incentive. I think the financing of each of these projects, each a $500 million, I can't even imagine the challenges of that. And so my understanding, and I'm not a finance expert, but my understanding is to, in order to be able to finance a $500 million project, which each of these were, you probably needed to be a separate a separate project, because to raise something $1.5 billion would have been difficult. So it was not the only reason, but still I can't argue that it's not an incentive. And going to your question about the updated rule that we have in place in 2012, you can look at the current rule, and you can compare it to the rule that we had back in 2008, and you can see quite a bit of improvement. In 2008, they just raised questions about some questions that you should consider, department, in order to determine the separate and distinct. 2012, much tighter criteria. At the same time, new director, I can tell you that I think the place really to work on could have been the rule that we have even in place today could be strengthened to be much clearer. At the same time, we've also made other improvements like on-site inspections. We increasingly do performance agreements to make sure that the financing in place is as it was represented. We increasingly use those also to verify that the project was built like it's supposed to, that it's still operating over time, like it said. So I think, I hope I've answered your question.
Well, the question you didn't answer was whether you know what the ownership is of the three LLCs. You instead went on to describe why you thought that wasn't a critical criteria, but I'd like to know the answer to my original question.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, I'm going to turn then to my staff and see if they have a more specific answer for you.
I guess what I'm asking is, how far behind these documents did you go to look at the real nature of the transaction, of the set of transactions, given that you had clear information that this started out as a single project?
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, your question really goes to the corporate structure. What you have is a parent company or a holding company who, you're absolutely correct, there was originally one application. They then, in attracting investors, look to the appetites of the investor. Each one of these LLCs comes with its own liabilities, its own risk, and it's carved up that way in order to take advantage of economies of scale, in order to mitigate that risk based on the investor's appetite. Yes, there is a holding company, but the holding company in and of itself is separate from the three LLCs.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, even though we're not voting, I want to disclose that my law firm represents the landowner under some of these projects, but has nothing to do with the developer. I look at this with enjoying the background of having worked to try to pass the legislation that resulted in these criteria. And I remember very clearly discussing with Chair Barnhart and others this exact issue. And we went through this innumerable times to avoid what now appears to have happened. And but because we're bringing this program to an end, the issue really is how can we make this exchange the most productive exercise? And because I'm sure your efforts were to try to save the state that $20 million, and there was no reason that you would do otherwise. The question I have, though, is it goes to some of the facts, and this is a debate on whether even to ask, right, because we're past. This is over. We're now looking back. So nonetheless, when I looked at what had happened, it was a classic form over substance situation, because I'm a lawyer. I form LLCs. I know how it works. And I guess I'm seeking to know if there were some other more solid facts that would support the decision ultimately made. For example, as they divided this project into three, when they recognized they might be able to get additional VETC credits, did that then increase the cost to them of the three projects as opposed to one? Because it would seem to me it would have. They would have had the additional financing cost for the three loans as opposed to one. They would have had the additional cost of the three substations as opposed to one. They would have had additional costs. And the question would then be, did that exceed the $20 million they then got? Because if it did, your argument and your decision would be far more supported. So I'm asking, did you guys look at how much additional cost the project had to pay as a result of dividing into three? and was there some actual substance, money paid out of these people's pockets that offsets substantially or maybe even exceeded the $20 million we are now giving them or have given them?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Bence, that's an excellent question. We clearly would say that having an individual substation, those things are very expensive. I don't know that we quantify the cost of that, but individual substations at each facility is extremely high cost. I'm not familiar with, but it sounds like you're familiar with the cost of financing, and I would imagine, and Anthony can verify this, that financing separately as opposed to altogether would certainly raise costs. As to whether we quantified that, I'm going to need to turn to staff and see what they might have done.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Bence. My experience with public finance, pretty much on the tax-exempt or taxable bond side, our rule of thumb is on any principal amount or any bond issue, we typically adjust up 2% for cost of issuance. The fund raise, the financing raise, the capital raise on this project to the tune of $1.7 billion plus the 2%, that doesn't include the interest that they're paying. I would tell you far exceeds the $20 million.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please, yes.
Right. Well, my question goes to the additional, did the department look into this? That's my question, because it would have supported then your decision, because obviously three projects should cost more than simply forming three LLCs and saying, well, gosh, we now have three subsidiaries, therefore we're separate. There had to be more to it than that, I hope. That's what I'm asking.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Bence, again, excellent question, excellent follow-up on that. What was done in 2008 when they were reviewed and pre-certified, I don't believe the statute provided the authority for the department to conduct that level of review. Stepping forward to current day, it is a logical question in my mind and is part of our review, how we have come to look at how these companies were financed. We did not go into the detail of the cost of financing and what cost savings they may have had. From my experience as part of this review, that's where I'm speaking from.
And Chair Barnhart and Chair Burdick, Representative Bence, I guess I just want to add that the division that Anthony administers does not just administer tax credits, it also administers the State Energy Loan Program. So Anthony lives and breathes these things. And before that time, he was at the Oregon Department of Transportation administering one of their loan programs, major loan program there. So, I mean, this is just part of his calculations in everything he looks at. This is what he lives and breathes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bailey, and then we'll go back to Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're having an excellent discussion here, but I want to see if we can bring this back to, I think, what the core of the issue is that we're looking at. You have a situation where the only way to separate the wheat from the chaff, especially when the chaff argues about it, is to have clear rules of the game. And so there's really, in my mind, only two questions at issue here. Were they the right rules? And were the rules followed? To the first point, were they the right rules? That question seems to be moot. The rules have changed. The program is ending. We have new management. And as illustrious as our chairs are, they cannot invent a time machine to go back and review those rules. So the question then becomes, were the rules followed? The memo that you've distributed to us and your testimony based upon it indicates that they were. We've heard some additional questions from the dais that raise some concern with that, specifically around, it sounds like, the ring bus issue and the management issue. It'd be great to get some clarity on that, find out what's going on. To help make a determination on where those rules followed at the time under different management. And I think when you pare away the rest of what we're looking at, that's really what's at issue here. And quick follow-up?
Mm-hmm, please.
The ring bus issue, help me understand. It sounds like what you're saying in the testimony here is that the evidence is that at the BPA facility, there was a single ring bus, which is perhaps crudely analogous to, I've got my TV, my Xbox, and my DVD player plugged into the same power strip, going out of my court, into my outlet, right? There are three different items connecting to one place that is not part of where they are. The other question would be, is it part of the same unit that then is traveling to the BPA facility? Is that right, or am I misunderstanding?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Bailey, in this case, might need a bit more refined analogy, and I'm not great at this, so I won't try to do it on the spot, but the ring bus is actually in Bonneville's flat substation. So it's wholly separate, and that's a facility owned at Bonneville. The substate, each of the wind farms has a separate substation on site, and that's what we look at. That's the first point of interconnection. And then from there, through lines owned by a separate entity, Caithness, Shepherd's Flat LLC, they go to that ring bus and so forth and travel out on Bonneville lines. As you know, the entire Western interconnection is interconnected. You know, all are parts of 14 Western states, provinces of British Columbia and Alberta, and a small piece of Baja, Mexico. So, you know, at some point you have to make a determination, you know, what are we talking about? Well, we have interpreted our, made our rules and interpret our rules to mean the first point of interconnection. And I think it's really evident when we have a separate, very expensive, large substation, discrete substation at each project that connects it on someone else's, you know, some other entity's lines to another facility owned by Bonneville. That's where the ring bus is. So to me, that's very far removed. I have no concerns about that. Which is, you know, why that we've disclosed all of this, all of the inspections, all of that information really was disclosed in our written testimony in the Department of Justice memo. So this is nothing new. We looked at all this and made our determinations appropriately.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just want to point you back to this, the notes, the narrative report from the ODE memo dated September 5th, 2012, and I'm reading it. The three wind turbine developments housed at the Greater Shepherd's Flat area do share a common ring bus located at the substation for North Hurlburt and an interconnection. That is not consistent with your testimony, and I don't understand how there could be that kind of difference between what you're saying and what the your staff is saying in their inspection. I want to answer the question of common ownership, at least to the extent that I can. It's very easy to go online and look at the filings to create business entities. They're available pretty much instantly on the Secretary of State's website. And so I did. And interestingly enough, all three, so this is an answer to your question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. All three of the LLCs are owned by, or their member and manager in most cases is Caithness Shepherd's Flat LLC, care of Caithness Corporation, 565 Fifth Avenue, 29th floor, New York, New York, signed by David Casale. So I don't know how much more common ownership you could have unless it is entirely form triumphing over substance. I don't know if you looked at this. I'm happy to share it, to put it in the record. These are all three Delaware LLCs, and they all three have to file to do business in the state of Oregon, and they're reporting their member, which is their owner, as the same Caithness who applied in the first place to have the single project and owns, I suppose, I had in your testimony, the substations and transmission lines are owned by Caithness Shepherd's Flat LLC. So the same company that owns the three applicants for the tax credit owns the transmission line and the substation, according to your testimony.
Yeah, that's right.
So common ownership, I don't know. I'm going to wrap up here because we have gone over time. I'm just going to make a couple of points, and then you can feel free to respond, but I'm just going to go through them, and you can pick out what you want to respond to now and what you want to follow up with later. But I do want answers to these questions. One of the factors that is used to determine whether or not these are separate projects is separate financing. you made mention of the fact that you don't know how hard it is to obtain $500 million in loans. Well, these were bonds, and I'll just, and this is not directed at you, but I'll just point out that I think my daughter's Bunny Buster could get $500 million in loans if the federal government guaranteed it, and they did. So there is common issuance of bonds, one federal loan guarantee, and I can cite the Department of Energy's release on this. It's December 17th, 2010. The Energy Secretary announces that a partial loan guarantee for a $1.3 billion loan has been finalized to support the world's largest wind farm, Shepherd's Flat. So you have bonds, you have a loan guarantee. That strikes me as common financing, one of the factors. You have common ownership. That also strikes me as one of the factors. And again, you can correct me if I'm misreading the rule, but I don't think so. Let me refer you to the federal, you actually, I think, cited the FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's order dated June 17, 2011. That's an order accepting shared facilities agreement and granting requests for waivers. You noted the waivers part of the order, but let me read from the order itself. The applicants explain that the shared facilities agreement between the three entities, the three LLCs, establishes the terms and conditions under which the applicants will jointly own, utilize, operate, and maintain certain shared facilities for the sole purpose of interconnecting their respective wind generation facility to the Bonneville Power Administration's power grid. Shared facilities, common effort, another factor down. You mentioned that there were multiple contractors. It's reported in altenergy.com that Blattner Energy is the balance of contractor, meaning, I think, the general contractor, for the Shepherd's Flat wind farm. And quoting from Lud Howe, the project manager for Blattner Energy, he says, it took us, I don't doubt, three solid months. We were meeting every day in the Blattner Energy corporate offices in Minnesota, talking about the details of Shepherd's Flat and determining how we were going to approach a job that was possibly going to take 3 years to build. We just knew it would take dedicated collaboration between Blattner, Caithness, and all members of the project team. He goes on to say, there was a lot of reasoning behind the approach to build the project in three phases. The power purchase agreements that the project owner, Caithness Energy, had called for certain milestones to be met in certain areas. There were north, central, and south phases of one project. It goes on for quite a bit as the contractor describes the level of coordination between the three phases of one project that were required to build this massive wind farm. One massive wind farm. What I have to conclude after listening to your testimony and after thinking this through a little bit, having not had the chance to read the materials that you submitted because we just got them at the beginning of the hearing, I have this feeling that there are no facts that would have caused you to determine that these were separate and distinct facilities, or for some reason the Department of Energy didn't look closely at this. And I got to tell you, this is $20 million. That may be small numbers to Caithness Energy. It's not to the state of Oregon. This is real money we're talking about that we could be using in other ways. And I know that you weren't there at the beginning of the project, and I'm not putting this on you personally, but I have a real problem with the fact that there doesn't appear to be a rigorous or extensive review or scrutiny of this project. And it strikes me as funny because, with the benefit of hindsight anyway, I think most people looking at this, just applying the common sense standard, would say, this smells. This looks like one project. It was one project until it became three projects to get the benefit of three tax credits. My question to you is, why are you not in the position of asking those questions, applying some common sense, and instead I almost get the feeling that it's a foregone conclusion that it had to be approved, and therefore it's our job to defend it.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Representative Conger, there was a lot there in your statement that we'll be happy to get back to you in more detail. And as you mentioned, with apologies, we were trying to get you the best materials we could. And so, in including the Department of Justice memo that we decided to release. So I think if you read those materials, you'll get a better feel for the timeline, for the rigor that we did apply. Again, we have to rely on the statute and our rule. Whether we can look back now and say, were the rules as rigorous as they could have, should have been, I think we could say that we could write a more rigorous rule. I wish I could go back in time and provide rules that would ask, you know, greater questions. I've got to say that we may and likely would have come to the same conclusion about these discrete projects, given the statute and our direction in terms of not requiring that the ownership be separate, but in fact that the projects and the facilities be separate. We have our rules speak to that following the statute, and we actually had no foregone conclusion, at least under my watch, in terms of whether the issuance of the final certificates that I signed were a foregone conclusion. That's not the case. We did an extensive review because of that. We work with Department of Justice because of that to ensure that under today's current rule, the current statute and our authority, were the final certificate something that I ought to sign? And I made that decision, yes, to do that based on all of the information that we had, all of the review that we did, including the re-review, when I came in and the applications for final certificates were in place. So I think we need to get back to you with more specific information and answer to some of the questions that you just raised, some of which are covered in testimony, some of which are probably not directly. So I think I'd like to get back to you, and we'll get back to the whole committee with those answers.
Thank you. Look, we're way over time, and I do very much appreciate your bringing all this information to us, and that the information you're going to be bringing later. I think from where I sit, as Representative Vance has pointed out, this has been a long voyage for the committee as well as for the department, as we have looked at this set of enterprises that we've been engaged in trying to encourage the development of renewable energy systems, conservation, and a whole variety of other things that you've alluded to in your testimony today. I think the key issue, and Representative Bentz definitely alluded to this, is the extent to which you have the authority now to make decisions for future projects or for projects that you're currently considering to use discretion to consider things that may not be specifically described in the rule. Now, as already been pointed out, we have caps in place on the amount of dollars you can spend, which were not in place when these rules were, or the statute was, these earlier statutes were adopted, that these projects were administered under. It necessarily has to be the case that you either award support based on the time an application arrives, or that you have the discretion to pick and choose or limit the size of the grant based on the fact that you have a limited number of dollars to spend. I would like you to review both the statute and the rule that you have now to determine whether you have the discretion to pick the best projects that are available and whether you have the discretion to limit the size of the support. And then to follow up on Chair Burdick's question, the extent to which you have the discretion to say, look, you can build this without any support from us or with limited support because it's economically viable for you to do so. And so I want to make this, we've been looking backward during most of this hearing. I want to make this, my question at least, a forward-looking question, because our task is to figure out, do we need to change the statute? Do we need to look at this system in a different way? Because we're faced constantly with sunsets that are coming along as we look at these things. And the committee is learning as we go, as well as is the department. So we very much appreciate, and I don't expect an answer to any of that today, but that's sort of where what I would like to see going forward is answers to those kinds of questions. And I'm really tempted to then make another comment looking back, and I'm not going to do it because I think it's been amply done already this morning. Is there something absolutely critical we have to
add one backward-looking request from the department, because I can't remember if I put it in my written questions or not, if I may, Mr. Chair. And that is to request that you look at the information that was provided by the applicant and you review the statute to see if there is an opportunity for the state of Oregon to recover its $20 million if the applicant misled the Department of Energy in its applications. I'm not saying it did. I don't know the answer, but I think a careful analysis of that is in order, given how much money is at stake and given the information that we were able to come up with a little help, that is contrary to, or appears to be contrary to the information that was provided in the applications, which you relied upon to view the Department of Energy. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, and I think that's a very very reasonable question. And you're right; it is backward looking. I think that's a great thing to be looking into. But I'm far more interested in going forward because, as I told you on the phone, if we can't administer these programs, we can't do them, mm-hmm. even though we really want to. Because I think most of the members of the committee, certainly the legislature, believes that it's important for us to get to a renewable energy future, to get to a future in which we don't use energy we don't have to use, in which we have a distributed energy system. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things that are critically important if we're going to have an economy and a civilization 50 or 100 years from now. But the question is, can we craft this thing in a way that we can actually do it without spending money that should be going to schools, healthcare, and public safety instead? And I appreciate your time this morning. And with that, we'll close this portion of our hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll move on. Associated Oregon Counties. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes. Gentlemen.
Morning.
Identify yourself for the record and present your testimony, if you would, please.
Morning, Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, members of the committees, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties, but probably more relevant for this discussion today. I'm the former Sherman County judge where many Betsy's have been applied, and former chair of the governor's renewable energy work group that brought you the renewables portfolio standard and the changes to the Betsy's back in 2007. I would like very dearly to get into a larger context about the Betsy itself, but it appears that this discussion is more focused today, and I have with me the judges from Gillam and Morrow County where these projects are located, and I want to make sure that they're able to get their comments before you and be here for your questions. I just want to remind you, as Chair Barnhart was stating, we got here because the goal of the state of Oregon is to move to a less fossil fuel-based energy regime and to have more of that energy based in the state of Oregon. And the first goal, RPS, got us by 2020, we heard yesterday, there, 20% of our power is going to come from renewable energy. The Betsy is what helped locate those facilities in Oregon. And we heard also yesterday that PGE's latest project is going to Washington, because as a, we've during the post-mortem here today on the late Betsy, it's no more. And essentially development in Oregon has ceased for a variety of reasons. But I wanted to show you the first picture here represents a view from my backyard in Sherman County, actually, of looking east. That's the western front of the wind farm as they extend out to the east over Gillam, Morrow, the Umatilla counties. Represents that view that you're looking, basically looking at towards Klondike, and the building you see in the center, low, is the Klondike elevator, which is 200 feet tall. Wow. At any rate, that represents Klondike 1, Klondike 2, Klondike 3, Klondike 3A, PGE, and if you go broader, 9 different projects that receive Betsy's. And how you distinguish them is very difficult. They all feed into one substation that goes on a power line owned by BPA over to the John Day substation. So not trying to open a can of worms here, but this relates to the previous discussion you've been having about how all this plays out and how we got all this renewable energy sited in Oregon. This has been a great boon economically for Sherman County and the state of Oregon. When I was there in 2004, Sherman County's assessed value, total value, the whole county, maximum assessed was $200 million. Today it's $2 billion. And if you apply the tax rates, permanent rates to those, and think about the return on investment from just the property taxes going to the school fund, as you saw earlier, and from the jobs, and from the lease payments going to the farmers, which come back in income tax, you'll find the return on the investment significant. So I'd like to have that discussion at some point in the future. But today, I think you need to hear from these judges where the Shepherd's Flat Caithness Project was located. So I'd like to introduce Judge Steve Schaefer from Gillam County.
Chairman Burdick, Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm here to talk to you about the benefits.
I'm sorry. For the record, would you state your name?
For the record, I am Gillam County Judge Steve Schaefer.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
I apologize. I'm here to talk to you about the benefits of wind energy had for Gillam County. It was a new industry that diversified our agriculturally based industry. It's got a reported $2.6 billion, and it's going to bring in $5.2 million to the general fund for Gillam County this year. It created 400 well-paying construction jobs during the phase of construction. This generated millions of dollars in sales of local goods to our businesses. It allowed our businesses to become more diversified, allowed them to make much-needed capital investment in the area. The big thing, though, is it allowed them to decrease their debt load that they had. It also allowed these businesses to increase their footprint of the area that they covered. The contractors and subcontractors also helped out in other areas. They were great supporters of some of the community events that we had. The chambers, the churches, Little League baseball teams, rodeos, all kinds of people received benefits from these people being in the area. The big thing with that, and this is the word I got back from the businesses, is that they helped them no longer to become the sole providers of these particular events. In small communities, these businesses get hit very, very hard on a regular basis to support those specific events. They also helped us in volunteer end of things. We have a difficult time on a regular basis in getting volunteers to be on the fire departments, the ambulance crews, you name it, whether they're coaching ball teams, whatever. When you're limited on the amount of population that you have, it's great to have these additional people. This particular project created 45 new jobs within our area. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot. But when you're in a community or a county of 2,000 people, 45 jobs is a lot. It It's going to bring in a $5 million average income for the county revenue. But that doesn't include the royalty payments that will come to the farmers, the landowners, and the people that these projects are on. That is an additional income tax that comes into our county as far as revenue. This revenue is going to be used to create water and sewer infrastructure within our cities. Some of these cities have pipe in the ground that's over 90 years old. We're building a new fire hall. It was the building that's being used right now was a service station back in the 1940s. It's an absolute mess. We also built Columbia Hills Manor. It's a senior living center in the Arlington area. And as you all know, senior living now is becoming of an urgency within any community at this time. Our roads and bridges, we're setting money aside to be able to take care of those in the future. Back in the 90s, Gilliam County run out of money. We literally had to lay off our entire road crew for 2 months in the months of May and June for us to be able to wait until the next fiscal year. That will never happen again. Daycare, preschools, our school district are receiving funding for this. The Condon School District this year will receive $450,000 from this particular project. That's very important for a school of 112 kids. Within that money, they're utilizing it for a college education program. Because it's such a small district, we're unable to offer elective programs. The elective programs that they get now are going to be college-based. We're also looking to put in a wellness center in our community. We believe that preventative health care is just as important as after illness care. Most of this would require state and federal funding. This money would have to come from somebody other than our taxpayers. There isn't enough of them. Maintenance on our rural roads, funding for social services, and ensuring public safety. That's my main job. I've been able to do it with this additional income that was a result of the Betsy tax that was given to these three entities. We need to continue with these kind of programs, not only for wind, but solar, geothermal, any other clean energy that is out there at this time. We thank you for this particular opportunity of being able to speak today. Hopefully I've answered most of the questions. I'm sure you have an awful lot more. I would be glad to answer any further questions that you may have. Thank you, Chair Burdick. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee.
Well, thank you for coming over to speak with us this morning. Please.
Just want to go ahead then?
Yes, please.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, Senator Burdick, Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Terry Tallman. I'm Morrow County Judge. I've been a judge since 1999. I'm approaching 70 years of age. I probably am choosing not to, at the urging of my wife, not to run again. But nonetheless, I have about 3 years left. I'm very interested in seeing a number of the things, just like the judge here from Gilliam County is cited. Very similar. We have a little larger population. I live in Boardman, right on I-84 there. Probably you're familiar with the name Port of Morrow. There's a lot of things going on there. My wife is a home health hospice nurse. She actually serves out of her district in Condon, and has spent many nights in Condon servicing folks in our area with needs there because of end-of-care needs and issues. So I'm quite familiar. Many of the things, very, very similar. I think probably the thing that I'm, and just listening to your discussion earlier in the day here, we never really ever did discuss Betsy. That wasn't a part of what we had in mind. The people that I consulted with most would be our land use planner in our county, our tax collector assessor, our finance director, and people like that. And ultimately then we would get to the point of where if we were having an entity like described from Shepherd's Flat come to us, would there be any incentives that the county might offer to encourage them to come to our county as well? And so in the consultation with all of those folks, and I should also mention my fellow commissioners, my Ken Grebe and Leanne Ray, they were heavily involved in that as well, and others. So anyway, we came with kind of an after the fact. We're in fact a new county at this. We have three wind farms, one about 67 megawatts, one about 80 some megawatts, and then the other one is the Caithness project, the Shepherd's Flat. The most important days to remember in all of this are January 1st of every year, because that tells us on January 1st how many megawatts are running. And because of the way that our project is selected, set up, we get paid on November 15th on the basis of what that January date, January 1 date told us. This will be our first actual year of payment from Shepherd's Flat. And the word that in Morrill County, and the word that we get on that January 1st date, 215 megawatts were running in Morrill County on that date. And so with the formula, just like the funding formula that you saw there that got all worked out, we worked out a funding formula for our incentive program. And we will be receiving in total roughly $2 million. And that will help us then accomplish all the things that were mentioned here earlier, that got mentioned earlier. So these last 2 years were probably our roughest years that, in all the years that I've been judge, that we experienced. We actually did have to take out a loan 1 year, which had never happened to me before, so it felt like something of a failure, to get from July 1st to November 15th. This money will take care of that. It will take care of our roads and similar needs along those lines. So it is a major, major boon to us. We would encourage, we know that the rules are changing. You know, it reminds me of the old song when my high school days, these times are a-changing. You know, we all remember, if you're old enough, you remember back to that song. They are, and they will. And so we just want to meet the challenge, and we'd like to encourage you to think along those lines. We're ready to meet that challenge. We want to meet that challenge. We will live within the rules. We just need to know what they are.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Senator Burdick.
Just an observation. First, I want to thank you for coming, and it really does gladden my heart to see the difference that this has made in some struggling counties, of which yours were two. I think what we're trying to get at here, this is also a profit-making business enterprise. And with any subsidy, you have to right-size it. And I think the evidence is really clear that we, and whether it's true in this case is still a matter of debate, but we over-subsidized many of these operations. In other words, they would have been there with a less of a commitment from the Oregon taxpayers. And that's real money in Oregon. I mean, it translates to teachers in the classroom. And so our job is, you know, as the revenue committees and as the Department of Energy, is to make sure that we get the best deal we can for the taxpayers. And that's what this is about. It's not about questioning the value of renewable energy or the tremendous impact it has in your county. It's just we have to be good fiduciaries of the taxpayer dollar. And I'm convinced in my mind that we grossly over-subsidized in many cases during that time period. That when you combine the state subsidies with all the federal subsidies and the loan guarantees and the, you know, the restructuring of the federal subsidies, that it became a windfall for oftentimes for Southern California ratepayers who were able to get lower rates from some of these wind farms because of the subsidy from Oregon taxpayers. That's what this is about. It's not about your county. I really appreciate your coming, and it does gladden my heart to see the specifics of how these things have made a difference. But our mission remains the same, that we have to make sure that the Oregon taxpayers are getting the best value for the dollars that they invest, because these are finite dollars.
Chair Barnhart, could I make one comment
there? Please, yeah.
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, and the members of the committee, and we agree. We feel like we as judges are in exactly the same boat.
Sure.
They're representing the citizens of our county, but also we're actually very regional. It isn't just us. It's very regional. I guess my only question would be, is that if you are going to get punitive in the future, we don't feel like we should be the one who would be the end, as we're kind of the end user in this deal, that we are the ones who bear the brunt of whatever punitive measures might come along. So I'd just like to ask you to keep that in mind, that because we have benefited, we realize that, and that's what we're speaking here very positively about today. But also at the same time, we don't want to be the one who then bears the brunt of what's going on if, with these changing thoughts, times, whatever, that we're asked to pull out of our pocket with what we've already got.
Thank you.
Just one comment.
That's not going to happen.
Okay, well, I appreciate it. I really do.
And I would say I would agree with that. Let me ask a question, and this may seem silly, but I ask it for illustration. Is there any space left in your counties for additional wind facilities or additional solar facilities to produce energy without burning carbon?
Yes,
absolutely.
There's a lot of room left in our electric grid system for the addition of additional energy source. As we learn more about battery technology, as Representative Bentz gets his big water battery built,
sounds like a great idea.
As other things happen, these things are going to be built out because we don't have any choice about it. It has to happen. And because you have the space and the wind and the sun, you're going to get them because that's what's going to happen.
And we encourage that. We've got actually notices of intent that I just read last week from a couple that told us they want to do something. Now, that's why it's so important that we know what the rules are.
Right. Well, and we're working hard to make it clear. Representative Conger, did you have something else?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I think what's happening to the economy in much of rural Oregon borders on catastrophe.
Yeah.
And so this may sound ironic, but I am very glad that that project got built, and I'm glad that your counties and the citizens of those counties are benefiting. The criticism or the questioning, I think, of the process by which the tax credits for this project were approved has nothing to do with second-guessing the outcome. I can't think of a reason why any penalty would come as a result of changes we would make in the program. But I am concerned because ultimately you have good projects that are getting built and you have benefits that are being enjoyed by people as a result of that, jobs and other things. But when you don't have control over the money that's coming out of the state government and you can't assure people that you have that control, I worry that, you know, this looks and smells like what people refer to as corporate welfare or crony capitalism, you know, bad things, very bad things that none of us wants to support.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart,
yes.
Members of the committee, I have one more comment that I was For the last 14 years, prior to becoming the judge of Guilliam County, I served on the Planning Commission for Guilliam County. I was one of the individuals who was responsible in okaying this project from the very first day. When it first came to my desk at that time, it was North Hurlburt and South Hurlburt. North Hurlburt had a purchase power agreement with Southern California. It was the project that was going to fly first. The second project, if they could get a purchase power agreement, was South Hurlburt. The third project was Willow Creek. Willow Creek was the name of it. It got changed to Horseshoe Bend, simply because we already had a Willow Creek wind that was in the area. Now, if you were to discuss this with some of the businesses in my area, I'm going to name a couple. The company that supplied the concrete for it and putting in the bid to Blattner Energy. These were three different bids. They got the first one. They did not get the second one. Ended up getting the third. The other one was the company that supplied the porta potties for this particular project. That ended up being three different entities for North Hurlburt, South Hurlburt, and Horseshoe Bend. Just a bit of information. So I'm not really sure.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Yeah.
It's factual.
Thank you.
Factual information to go along with what the department has already told us. We very much appreciate the fact that you have traveled over to Salem to present this information to us, and the effort that you've put in, you and your commissions have put in to maintain your county government systems and services in place, and that you clearly care about those things, and we appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you.
Appreciate it. Let's move along to the department's Department of Revenue's comments on DOMA. And colleagues, while she's coming up, I'd simply note that we're scheduled to end at 11 o'clock. It's my understanding the room is not scheduled at 11. We may run over a few minutes because we're so far behind. Those who can stay, I appreciate that.
We can skip the last one.
Yeah, that's fine.
Good morning, members
Good morning.
Of the committee. My name is Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue, for the record. And I might be able to help you with a little bit on that time issue we have here this morning. As far as the Defense of Marriage Act, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on where we are and where what has happened in the last couple of months and where we are today. In June of 2013, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act was not constitutional under the Fifth Amendment. The issue in that case was same-sex couples, Edith Windsor and Thea Spire, married in Ontario, Canada, and the state of New York recognized their marriage, but the federal government did not. It was an estate tax case, and when Spire died, she left her entire estate to Windsor. And, of course, there was a tax consequence at the federal level, which they then appealed, which is the basis for the Supreme Court case. The piece of DOMA that they did not talk about was the fact that states can still have, they can still decide whether or not to recognize marriages that are entered into by other states. So it left part of DOMA, it didn't overrule all of it. So what that did was it left all the states kind of wondering, what are we supposed to do now for those states, especially like Oregon, that have a constitutional provision that says marriage is only recognized if it's between one man and one woman. So in August 29th, the IRS finally came out with a ruling that said it's going to recognize marriage in the same-sex marriage in the state basically of celebration. So if the state recognizes it, they will allow a joint federal filing. So that leaves us even more in a unclear position where we are today. We have conflicting they relied heavily on the Supreme Court decision talking about the terms husband, wife, and husband and wife, and spouse, which was the part that they overruled the Section 3 part in their determination. So we have, Oregon is one of 29 states, actually, that has a constitutional prohibition, and we have several laws beyond that that cause some confusion over how we are supposed to interpret this. The Family Fairness Act provides for registered domestic partnerships for same-sex couples, which we already allow them to file joint tax returns. We also tie to the definition of federal taxable income, so that kind of complicates it because we start with the federal return as we prepare the Oregon return. We also have laws that tie to the definitions used in federal law, which this case is exactly at issue. So based on all these conflicting laws, what we've done is we've asked our AG for opinion on what it is exactly we need to do. There's the decision is far more, is far-reaching. It goes beyond taxation, obviously. It goes to taxability of taxability of income for employers, but it also goes to health insurance and other areas of the law. So they're really taking their time looking at to see what the actual broad issues are. As far as the taxation issues go, as soon as we know what the Department of Justice advises us, we have a communication plan in place. We plan to talk to our practitioner community, our employer community. We already are directing people to our website once we know. In our current forms and publications, we're beyond that point. So that's basically where we are at this point. We're kind of in a holding pattern until we know more about all of the interplay of Oregon law, Oregon Constitution, federal Supreme Court case, and federal law. So with that, if you have any questions.
I think what you said is we're not sure yet. We're looking into it.
That's essentially it. Yes, sir.
All right. Questions? Is there any restriction that you're aware of that would prevent someone who married or a couple that married in a state where it's legal to do so? I think you call it the state of celebration. Who becomes an Oregon resident, or maybe is an Oregon resident, to also have a domestic partnership registered in Oregon? Is there any restriction on that as far as you know?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I do not know of anything like that. And I believe we have some taxpayers that are already in that situation.
Right. So the taxpayer can neatly solve all of your problems by doing both, can't they?
That is, Chair Barnhart, that is correct. My understanding, yeah.
Right. Thank you. Anything else? Let's go ahead then and talk about e-cigarettes. Growth of e-cigarettes, revenue policy implications, LRO and the Department of Revenue. Is that, that's Mazza.
Director of Vice.
Yes, our own Director of Vice.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick. We'll talk about, I'll take the e-cigarettes subject after the Department of Revenue. Diana would like to start with some of the description of the e-cigarettes you would find in all those documents, the document that says the construction of e-cigarette.
Yes. That's second to the last item on our list of documents for today.
So that's the one that Diane is going to start with.
Thank you, Mazin. Again, for the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And when we were asked to come forward and talk about e-cigarettes, I thought, what is an e-cigarette? And so I did a little bit of research. I thought it would be helpful for the committee to understand what exactly an e-cigarette, an electronic cigarette is, and how they're marketed kind of at a high level. So I provided a graphic for you that was and some text that was I found in a USA Today article basically describing what these cigarettes are. And as you can see, they have some sort of a battery source, and they convert the nicotine usually that's in the product in a liquid form into a vapor that is then inhaled. Usually it is these devices simulate a cigarette. They look like a cigarette, although they sometimes look like pens. They sometimes look like other devices that aren't quite like an actual cigarette. Some of them release nicotine, which is a derivative of tobacco, and some of them just release a flavored vapor. They do come in, the nicotine comes in all kinds of different flavors, peach, and there's the list goes on. But they, what I've also learned is that they are called, it's called vaping as opposed to smoking. And people who, instead of smokers, they're vapers, and they vape because they're inhaling vapors, apparently. So, and it is ER, not OR. So there are some issues around the different types of them. Some of them have liquid cartridges. Some of them are refillable. Some of them are disposable. It's just they're marketed in all kinds of different ways where, like the inhaler tip is actually a refill piece, or it's a throwaway piece, or there's liquid that you put into them. So there's a variety of ways these things come, and they have a variety of nicotine levels in them, is what we understand. So the taxation issues that we have surrounding these is that in all but one state, e-cigarettes are not taxed. Minnesota in 2010 took forward a legislative change to say that derivatives of tobacco are also taxed, so it included nicotine. The U.S. Department of Treasury does not tax. It's administered through the Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, the TTB, and they also do not tax it. And Oregon's statutes, from what I've been told, are very clear that it has to be a form of tobacco or some sort of tobacco, which these do not have in them. There are federal issues that you might be hearing about, and those are through the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They actually have rule writing authority to be able to regulate these as a form of tobacco, which we do not have. Oregon does not have that sort of liberty there to be able to do that. They do plan to announce some rules, the FDA, in, I believe, October of 2013 is what we're being told. Currently, the tobacco taxes in Oregon are structured such that we have a tax on cigarettes, which is 5.9 cents per stick or $1.18 a pack or $11.80 a carton, which I'm sure you're aware of. A distributor purchases tax stamps from us and affixes those to each packet of cigarettes. We have a weight-based tax with a minimum, which is what we tax the moist snuff, which is the Copenhagen, the Kodiak, the Skoll, those products, with at $1.78 per ounce. The minimum weight for those is $2.14 per tin, and I think there are some that are heavier. We also have a tobacco tax on other tobacco products of 65% of the wholesale sales price, which this is your chewing tobacco, your plug tobacco, the pipe tobacco, your shisha, and that is based on the purchase price of the tobacco product, with cigars included in that at a maximum of 50 cents per cigar. So if the legislature chooses to tax these, which is why I understand we were brought here, is to kind of give you some policy options here, there are some issues that we see at a high level, which, again, this is an emerging issue. We haven't had a chance to really do a lot of study on this. But we understand that there are there could be some equivalency issues relating to backing into how much nicotine is in a product to the equivalent tobacco weight. That might be an issue. Again, I talked about the e-cigarettes coming in a variety of forms. They could come in liquid bottles, little tiny bottles, bigger bottles. They have different levels of nicotine in each one. These are things that Minnesota is starting to learn about. They're disposable, they're refillable. There's all kinds of different ways to. The charger can be used indefinitely, the stem part of the cigarette. So there are some issues there that you'd have to consider. If you chose to follow the path of down like we do with cigarettes, we're not exactly sure how e-cigarettes are distributed right now. We haven't learned that part. They've been in the country for about 6 years, and most notably just the last couple years, they've really come to popularity. So affixing like a stamp probably isn't practical, but we don't know yet. So We also know that these are sold in non-standard locations. They're sold in mall kiosks. They're sold in some of the standard locations, liquor stores, grocery stores, that kind of thing. But they're sold in the little carts in the center of the mall or the strip malls, where we're not really sure what that retailer base looks like yet. But we do know it is an emerging issue, and it is at the national level. And we've been working with other states to find out what their issues are, what they're struggling with, at the federal level, what they're struggling with. So we haven't had a chance to actually do a complete assessment on this, but we do know that it is an issue, and it is something that we're looking into. So if you have any questions about anything I've just explained, happy to answer them for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick and then Representative Vance.
This is out of your area of expertise, so I apologize, but where does the nicotine come from?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the nicotine is in liquid form.
But
and it's in, if you look at the picture, it's in this particular, it's derived from tobacco, if that's what your specific question.
It's not chemically synthesized. It actually comes from tobacco.
Yes, that's my understanding. It is derived from tobacco. There are other sources of nicotine, from what I understand. It's a member of the, I think, Nicotana family of the nightshade genus is what I've been told, I believe. Going back away.
next they'll be smoking eggplant.
But there are about in that family, there's I think about 2,800 different families, and so it goes, I think there's multiple sources, but the most practical one and the one that I understand manufacturers are coming from the tobacco plant.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The material of the USA Today material in the record suggests that there's still concern or confusion over whether these things are as harmful or less harmful or what as a real cigarette. For our purposes in creating policy regarding these new things, we would need a pretty clear understanding if these are the same as or a safer alternative to smoking. So are you aware of any of that type of research that's ongoing? Because, for example, if there was a thought that someday we might tax these things as we now do cigarettes, I'm sure there is that thought, it would seem odd that we would disincentive folks from trying to move away from something that's dangerous to something that's less so. But the premise is that they're less so. So where are those studies and are they being done?
Chair Barnhart and Burdick and Representative Bentz, as far as I know, that's one of the big controversies at the federal level is the harm, the health pieces of it. From my department standpoint, that is not something that we are doing. I am aware, though, that they are testifying tomorrow in the Judiciary Committee about some of the health concerns and regulatory concerns about e-cigarettes and sales to minors, sales use in public places, that kind of thing. But as far as our role in that, we have not done any study on the health implications of the use of e-cigarettes.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is really probably not a topic for the Department of Revenue, but I'm concerned about the fact that these devices are, I think, available to kids. I don't believe there's any restriction on kids buying them, is there? As far as you know?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, as far as I know, I don't know of any. I just don't know of any.
Right.
But I don't know that there isn't either. Right. I know in a personal experience I had, I walked by one just to see what these were about, and the clerk asked me if I was 18. I don't know if there's I don't know if he was just trying to flatter me or if he was being serious, but he definitely asked me that question.
Okay.
So I don't know if there's a rule.
And then, of course, the other issue that it's not in your purview is the issue of where people can use them. Because, of course, the vapor is released into the air, and other people will breathe it. I happen to be sitting next to a man at the airport in a clearly no-smoking area who was using one of these devices, and that disturbed me quite a bit when I realized that he was doing it. And then the final piece for me has to do with the safety issue that Representative Vance raised, because we don't know about how this addictive substance called nicotine by itself differs from the gamut of chemicals that are found in tobacco. Representative Burdick.
Never mind. We need to get caught up. We could get lost in all the weeds.
Yeah. That, again, those are not subjects for this committee. They're probably subjects for the Health Committee and Judiciary Committee. And
we will be coordinating, Mr. Chair, at some level.
Yeah. On those issues. And of course, I'm always interested in keeping drugs away from kids and in generating some money. So I'm always interested in those two things, as has been noted lately in the press. Shall we move on? Or do you have some things?
I just want to bring it to your attention, Mr. Chair and members, that the documents in OLIS, the USA Today e-cigarette article, kind of goes through some of these issues. Then you have a Wall Street Journal article that came earlier away in the year, and I kept that, and it's titled Big Tobacco, and I know Big Tobacco is a favorite name that Mark Nelson likes. So the Big Tobacco getting into the different brands and offering a whole different entry into the market. The numbers are not very clear yet. You have about $500 million of sales in the 2012, and then projected about a $1 billion. This is relative to about $300 billion of sales in on the other cigarettes. So you're approaching the 1% and the 2%. The different type of statistics that exists talk about 5% of smokers actually smoking e-cigarettes, 5.5, but that is obviously there is no very hard statistics on that. I have other stuff here too that explores the revenue of tobacco, basically in this is a tax collection SIG and OTP tab here that you have, and it shows the different amounts of revenue coming in from cigarette tax and other tobacco product. It shows primarily the total is constant. However, the cigarette amounts are slightly or actually declining about 2.5% per year. However, the other tobacco product tax is increasing, and a lot of that is the reason by the moist snuff type of arrangement that was introduced in 2009 and 2010, which brings us to the idea of taxing this as talking to legislative council. There is a difference in the other tobacco product tax of how to tax these different new issues. You would think that the other tobacco is an immediate place where this would exist. However, to identify some tax base or tax unit, if you will, just like we did with the tobacco by weight, the moist snuff is probably the need of new definitions for that. Finally, you have in your materials the definitions of cigarettes in ORS 323 and also the definitions of the other tobacco tobacco products tax, ORS, as well. Those are the definitions of tobacco products in case you want to examine how and why these types of new devices do not lend themselves to the existing definitions that we have, and we needed probably a new task force led by Representative Gelser to get an examination of that new type of tobacco delivery or nicotine delivery system.
Thank you. Any questions for these two at this point? I think we have a lot of questions to look at, but not much definitive information right now. I think it's clear that at least some of us will be likely to pursue some of these issues. The growth of the use of these devices and the fact that we're dealing with an addictive substance suggests that we need to pursue it. And I suspect that some of the same issues apply to e-cigarettes that do to tobacco products, whether this is a tobacco product or not. We probably will want to consider rules that are more inclusive, because the inventiveness of the human being what it is, somebody will come up with something that's not, doesn't look like an e-cigarette and will be called something else, but will be another way of applying these addictive substances in ways that we need to deal with. If our long-term goal, which is to help people not start using them and eventually get off of using them for health reasons and other reasons, is to reach for fruition. Thank you. We appreciate the input, and I've lost my agenda. Where am I? Way over here. There it is. State and local government revenue, newly released census data.
Mr. Chair.
We still have 8 minutes. I suspect we can get through this.
Yes, well, I'll simulate Paul Warner with this. Let me try to do it in a in as interesting way as he does it. This important census data, at least for us, because it has the state and local segment of taxes and revenue finances, and you have here in your document about five. Without the cover page, slides that put these new releases of the census data into perspective, the revenue per capita, and this is the important of this, I guess I have to mention, is these are the first set of numbers that come after the official recession that we went through, and then all the different adjustments and changes. So it is starting to look into a different stabilization form. And as you see, the first one, you have in Oregon, and you have some numbers are in the red to bring it to your attention how overemphasize those percentages, such as the taxes in Oregon. And percentage of how it is relative to other states. And then you have your second slide where you have the per capita for the both Oregon and the Western comparison is in your fourth, and you have Oregon, Washington, California, Nevada, and Idaho, and you see how that all comes into as taxes and as in general total amounts of revenue sources, and how Oregon, when you also take out the federal amounts, comes down to about some of the lowest. And then you would have the state and local taxes in the Western state tax structure, and you would see the overexposure of Oregon to the personal income tax, as well as the overexposure of Washington to the general sales tax at 45.5%. These are the different images that you have for these two, for Oregon and our neighbors. Also the property tax, when it's over 30%, that's also an amount that is significant to look at for any of these states. And finally, for the as percentage of total personal income tax in Oregon, it is still 67% of total, while Washington has 60.2% of its total due to the general sales tax, and that's more balanced in the case of California. And Nevada probably is slightly different, but Idaho as well. So these are the amounts and the statistics that we wanted to bring to your attention with this new release, and how it is slightly different and gives a different picture from the 2009 release that the census data has.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burke.
I'm surprised by the property tax number, that Oregon is so low and Washington is so high. Does Washington's include the vehicle tax, which I understand is pretty high?
Maybe.
The property the Western the tax structures for state tax, there you go. On the property tax, we're only 0.2% for property tax.
Yeah, something's wrong with that.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Other hands are personal property.
Are you giving them 0.2%?
It's on page 6.
Doesn't that look pretty low to you?
Well, it's, well, I'll look into that, but it seems the this is as percentage of total individual taxes.
These are state taxes.
Well, maybe it's because of that. It doesn't
state taxes.
The state tax, it takes out the local
right.
portion.
Right.
Okay.
When you go to the local portion, when you have state and local taxes put together, we are at 35.8.
Well, then I'm surprised that we have any at all, because I didn't think we had a state.
Well, what is termed as property tax is the some of the fees that we have on titles. This is for the ORMAP and the amounts that are put on title transfers for the housing, Department of Housing. There's just very few.
Centrally assessed property, would that come under there? No, that's aligned to the local.
No, but we have $1 per transaction for ORMAP. This is the electronic mapping that you know we do with the Department of Revenue. And then if you recall, about three sessions ago, housing had also an additional dollar and something, I guess, for the housing.
It's property based.
Yes.
Yeah. There's property based taxes. So. We have a little. Okay. I think it would be useful to understand what the differences are between Oregon and other places. I'm looking at the very first chart, for example, and maybe, and I don't expect an answer today, but we pay $200 more than the typical state per capita in federal taxes. Our tax revenue is $600 less, $650 less, but then we make up for some of that with charges and then to a lesser extent some of this, whatever's in the miscellaneous category. I know about the charges piece, of course, because we charge a lot of fees to try to make up for the fact that our revenues are short. But it would certainly be interesting to understand why it is that Oregon is a fairly low-income state, and yet we still pay $200 more than the average state in federal taxes.
Mr. Chair, these are like receipts rather than payments. So
these are receipts.
Yes. So this what
these are federal. So these are this is a good number,
that's
not
a
bad
number.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
We're receiving $260 more than less.
I probably should not look at that one too closely, except to figure out how to make it bigger, right? All right.
The gift horse.
Yes.
You're looking right.
Thank you. I do appreciate the clearing up of my misunderstanding. Other questions, comments? I assume we'll get more detail on this as it's available. Good. Thank you. Madam Chair, any other business today?
Not for me, Mr. Chair. Well done.
Thank you all so much, and we are very appreciative of the good attention. And with that,
ended on time.
The House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
The Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is adjourned.